Well, we've reached the final unit. Just three more chapters left. And the first of those, which we're starting right here, is about meiosis and sexual life cycles. We'll get into meiosis in a little bit, but first let's have a little talk about sex. Sexual reproduction is only one type of reproduction, and it's the more recent. Originally, all reproduction was asexual, and still most organisms on Earth reproduce asexually simply because most organisms on Earth by far are bacteria. But there's plenty of other asexual reproducers as well. Anyway, that's a pretty fundamental difference. Asexual reproduction involves just one parent. And that parent produces offspring that are genetically identical to the parent. Very similar to when you just copy your own cells to produce more within your body, like new skin cells. Sexual reproduction, on the other hand, involves two parents, and the offspring that are produced, however many, aren't genetically identical to either parent, because the offspring of sexually reproducing species are genetically a mixture of the genetic makeup of both parents. That's the whole essence of sex, that it produces offspring by including some of the genetic material from each of the two parents. Not only are sexually reproduced offspring not identical to either parent, they're also not identical to each other. How, you know, if there are multiple offspring produced by the same parents, they'll all be genetically distinct. Now, you see an example picture for each of these two major modes of reproduction. An asexual reproducer on the left. This hydra is a protist. So it is a eukaryote, but it's not an animal, a plant, or a fungus. It also happens to be a unicellular protist. And unicellular organisms in general reproduce asexually, but not only unicellular organisms. Anyway, how asexual reproduction occurs depends on the species. This hydra undergoes what's called budding. Basically, a new version of this original hydra starts sprouting out of its body and then eventually detaches. And that new one will be genetically just like the original one. The redwoods on the right, like plants in general, or a lot of groups of eukaryotes, reproduce sexually. But plants, by the way, many species of plants can do either one. They can reproduce sexually or asexually, which is why, you know, a piece of cactus, for instance, that falls off of a potted cactus and lands in your yard will start growing a new cactus that's genetically identical to that original parent. Well, anyway, there's nothing saying that either of these two modes of reproduction is better than the other or is the correct way. Both of them have advantages and disadvantages. What would be an advantage of asexual reproduction? Based on what I've told you about it, namely that it produces offspring that are genetically identical to the parent. Under what situation, in other words, would that be the way to go if you had a choice? Yeah.
When they have those benefits, would that
be? Exactly right. Yeah. If that parent, before reproducing, is very well fit to its environment, it's well adapted, which is because of its particular genetic makeup, then why would you want to mix anything up? right? Just make another one exactly like it, and the assumption is that that offspring will be just as well adapted. So yeah, that is an advantage. But what's the problem with that thinking? What does?
If you're in the woods, it's winter.
Right, the environment doesn't actually stay the same. Natural selection has adapted that individual, or the species, and that individual is well adapted because of that evolution that's occurred in the species. Adapted it for a particular environment, though, right? And environments can abruptly change just randomly, like because of an earthquake or whatever. And so, yes, asexual reproduction by producing genetic clones is good if the environment never changes, but that's never true. It's always at least subtly changing. And so this brings up the major advantage of sexual reproduction. Sexual reproduction is a crapshoot, basically, because you never know what you're going to get when you involve two parents and combine their DNA into one offspring. The offspring will have some traits of one parent, some traits of the other parent, but the particular mixture you get, totally random. And so it's not necessarily true that that offspring is going to be as well adapted as the parent, or is either parent. It might not be as well adapted because it's random. But the reason overall that sexual reproduction is advantageous is that, especially for organisms that produce a lot of offspring, chances are one or some of them will be even better adapted than the parents are. And specifically, by having it randomly produced, it might be, even if the environment changes, some of those offspring might be adapted to these new conditions, whereas making a carbon copy, they wouldn't be. So there's advantages and disadvantages. Well, a disadvantage of sex, other than the fact that you can produce offspring that aren't as well adapted as you, as the parent, is also that it's more trouble that you have to go through. You have to involve two individuals. They have to get their gametes together somehow. You know, not all sexual species mate. Some of them never encounter each other, like two trees living miles apart. But you still have to involve both of them. The pollen has to blow or be carried by some animal to the other parent. So it's just, you know, a more complicated process. That's a disadvantage as well. But it pays off for a lot of species, which is why, you know, multicellular organisms in general are mostly sexual species. Okay, now let's go to 2 and look at this black background photograph we see here, which is an example of what's called a karyotype. Now, what does that word remind you of?
I mean, eukaryote?
Right. It's the same root as in prokaryote and eukaryote. The karyo means core or center. It really refers to the nucleus in a cell. And so karyotype got its name because it's a photographic representation of all of the chromosomes in the cell of a eukaryotic species. This happens to be a karyotype for a human, and that's why you can see that there are 23 different pairs of chromosomes here. There's 46 overall chromosomes, but there's 23 pairs because each pair contains two chromosomes that correspond to each other, which I'll explain more in a minute. Yeah, go ahead.
We're looking to the photographic wood.
It's a photographic representation of all of the chromosomes in a eukaryotic organism. And, you know, it's a true photograph. This isn't a drawing. But, of course, these chromosomes don't pose this way, right? So, it's a doctored photograph because these chromosomes have to be arranged like this. They're not only arranged so that each of the two chromosomes that correspond to each other are next to each other, but also notice that they're arranged in order of size, biggest to smallest. In reality, when you take a picture of a cell, well, first of all, if you take it randomly in the cell cycle, you're probably not going to see any chromosomes, right? Because as we talked about, we don't even use the word chromosome until the chromatin has condensed to the point where you see individual pieces. That's when we call them chromosomes. And what specific part of the cell cycle features the most condensed chromatin, and therefore the most compact chromosomes? Metaphase, yes. Metaphase is when the snapshots are taken to produce a karyotype. So these are metaphase chromosomes, but of course they wouldn't be like this in the cell. They would be arranged as you already have studied metaphase to be. You then, well, in the old days it was true cut and paste. You would take scissors, make a photograph of it, print the photograph, take scissors and cut each little one out, and then arrange them this way, and then take another picture of that. And, you know, truly pasting them with actual glue. Now you just do the same thing electronically. But that's how you can arrange them to make the overall karyotype. And any given eukaryotic species could have a karyotype, but this one's a human. And I know that because of the fact that there's 23 kinds. I've told you already that when we talked about differences in chromosomes between prokaryotic and eukaryotic cells, that eukaryotic cells have linear chromosomes, and they have some number of them, right, which depends on the species. Well, for humans, it's 23. For a different, you know, a corn karyotype would have 40. They have 40 chromosomes. The cartoon that's on the left, which is just a cartoon rendition of this first pair of chromosomes, is easier to look at because then you see that each of these individual chromosomes in the pair, one side of this, is not only a chromosome but a replicated chromosome. So this left chromosome is half of the pair, but just the left chromosome itself has a right and left half. You see that? We've talked about replicated chromosomes already, right? A replicated chromosome consists of two sister chromatids that are identical, hooked to each other at a centromere. So these two sister chromatids are identical to each other in this one replicated chromosome. These two sister chromatids are identical to each other in this other replicated chromosome. But the chromatids in these two different replicated chromosomes are not identical to each other. Nevertheless, they correspond to each other. They're the same type of chromosome. Specifically, we call this one number one, chromosome number one, simply because it's the largest pair. But that's why they correspond. They're not only the same size, they also have the same types of genes. Same number of genes and same genes for the same set of characteristics. All right? We call this relationship homology, and therefore the adjective form to use is that we say these two replicated chromosomes are homologous chromosomes. If we want to talk about one of the two homologous chromosomes in a pair, we call it a homolog. Okay, so a homologous pair contains two homologs. The karyotype of a human does have 23 pairs because there are 23 types of chromosomes, but notice we don't use the number 23. The 23rd pair is some combination of X and Y, either two X's or an X and a Y. So that brings up another definition. All of these first 22 types of chromosomes in a human are examples of what are called autosomes, What does auto mean? Self, yes. And so means body. It's the same ending as in chromosome. Chromosome itself means colorful body, because chromo means color. But autosome has the same ending as chromosome because an autosome is a chromosome. It's just one type of chromosome. The other type are sex chromosomes. And those are called that not because they have only to do with sex, but they're called sex chromosomes for species that have them because they are involved in determining the sex of the offspring, if any offspring are produced, and the sex of the individual, I should say, not just the offspring. But these first 22 in humans, those are the autosomes, and they contain the 20 plus thousand genes that humans have that code for the more than, you know, the roughly 100,000 proteins that humans can produce from those genes. And autosomes is a good descriptor because those genes that the autosomes contain are all about the life of that individual, its self, in other words. The sex chromosomes, on the other hand, are not just about that person's life. They're also about the next life, determining the sex of the next generation. And that's why they're called sex chromosomes. Okay, now, one question I have for you is, why is it that there are two of each kind of chromosome here? Right, because we are examples of a species that reproduces sexually, meaning that we have two parents, and therefore, in such species, each individual gets one of each kind of chromosome from each of its two parents. So this person got one of these number ones from his mother and one of these number ones from its father. And so, and similarly for all the other 22 pairs we see here. All right, so this brings up still another important definition. And this is one that a lot of students struggle with grasping right at first. So listen carefully. We're going to talk about ploidy. That's a general word. Ploidy is how many of each type of chromosome that a cell contains. And so, what would that be for this karyotype? Based on that exact definition I just gave you. Ploidy is how many of each type of chromosome a cell contains. Which is totally different from how many chromosomes it contains. Right? How many chromosomes it contains, or how many types there are, that is a different definition. That's an, which we'll talk about in the next slide. But ploidy is not that. Ploidy is how many of each kind there are. The N, by the way, for humans is 23. There's 23 different kinds of chromosomes. The ploidy is how many of each of those 23 the cell has. So what would be the answer for this?
26.
No, that would be the total number of chromosomes.
22.
Yes. There are two of each type of chromosome here. You see that? There's two number ones, there's two number twos, so there's two of each. That's the ploidy. Except we don't use the number to indicate ploidy, we use words. In a cell that has two of each kind of chromosome, we call that cell a diploid cell. That would be the adjective. We would call the condition diploidy, because di means two. If a cell, on the other hand, has only one of each kind of chromosome, however many there are, then instead it is a haploid cell. All right. Let's go on to the next slide and hopefully make this more clear. The symbol N is also called the haploid number for whatever species we're talking about. In slide 3, this is a made-up species, whatever this is, that this cell represents. But think about humans. What is the haploid number, which is N, for humans?
23.
That means that there are 23 different kinds of chromosomes, which is different from the total number of chromosomes. Remember I said that the two number ones are the same type. That's why they're homologous. They have the same genes, not necessarily identical genes, but they have the same set of genes governing the same set of traits, the same set of characteristics. Whereas the genes that are on number two or any other number, those control totally different characteristics. All right? That's what makes it the same type of chromosome. They govern the same characteristics. And since there's 23 different kinds in humans, that's what N is. That's the haploid number. So for humans, a haploid cell, which is not the one that picture was taken from, the previous slide, a haploid human cell would have 23 total chromosomes. Because haploid means having only one of each kind. Okay? Now let's look at this made-up species. This cell has an N of what? Just look at the picture. Don't cheat and look at the answers. Make sense of it. No, N is not 6. N is the number of different kinds of chromosomes. If you were to make a karyotype of this cell, you would notice that there are two large, two medium, and two small. And you'd arrange them that way, right? In pairs. So there are three kinds of chromosomes here. Big, medium, and small. And therefore, N equals 3 for this species, whatever it is. Now, what about the ploidy? What's the ploidy? Except that I said we don't use the number for ploidy. We use a word. It is true that there are two of each type of chromosome here, right? There's two large, there's two medium, there's two small. But what word do we use if a cell has two of each type? A diploid, exactly. This is a diploid cell. Remember I said that the haploid number is described by the symbol N. That's what N means. And the reason it's a variable is because it depends on the species. Each species has its own N. But N is the haploid number. The diploid number can be also symbolized simply as 2n, because diploid means having two of each of those n types. And that's why you see 2n equals 6 up here. Well, 2n equals 6 algebraically also tells you that n must be 6. I mean, must be 3, right? But I don't want you to just read that. I want you to make sense of it in this picture. There are three kinds of chromosomes here. Large, medium, and small. By the way, the kinds aren't the colors. Don't think that there are two kinds here, red and blue. What does red and blue indicate here? Right, they represent the parental origin of those chromosomes. It's not really mom and dad, it's this is the child, or this is the offspring, right? But the blue ones were donated to this cell from the father, or the paternal set, and the red ones from the mother. All right, so this is a diploid cell in which n equals 3, and notice that each of these chromosomes is replicated, which is why, you know, which should make sense in terms of what you know about the cell cycle. DNA replication occurs in S when the chromatin is still loose. You don't see anything yet. So by the time it does condense into a visible chromosome, it's already replicated. That's why each of these consists of two identical sister chromatids. But these two sister chromatids, one red and one blue, are not identical, because the two homologs within a homologous pair are not identical, since the two parents were not genetically identical. Is that all clear? Now, when I say that the same type of chromosome, the two homologs, have the same genes, gene families, I should say, they govern the same set of characteristics. The reason that that can be true, even though they're not genetically identical, is that there are, within a population, different versions of the same gene. For instance, a gene to produce a specific enzyme. There's not just one gene that specifies how to build that enzyme. There's differences because of mutations. All right, they both are a gene, though, that codes for that enzyme. They just code for slightly different versions of that enzyme. Whereas a totally different gene would code for, let's say, hair color. That would be at least a different gene, maybe on the same chromosome, maybe not, but maybe on a totally different chromosome. So when I say the same two chromosomes are of the same type, that means they have the same number of genes, even though those genes aren't identical to each other, and those genes govern the same set of characteristics as each other. All right, now let's go on to 4 and talk about sexual life cycles. This uses humans as an example, just because familiarity, since you're a human, might make it easier to understand at first. But perhaps the most important thing about this slide is true not just of humans, but of all sexually reproducing species. And that is that in any sexually reproducing species, there is a generation to generation, so not within one lifetime, a generation to generation alternation between two important events. And those are meiosis and fertilization, as you see here. So when you go from parent to offspring, and then those offspring have their own offspring, and so on, from generation to generation, the life cycle keeps going back and forth between fertilization and meiosis. we'd better then define these two things, starting with fertilization. Fertilization is the hallmark of sex. It's really what defines sexuality in a species. So, if there's no fertilization, then that species is not a sexual species. Fertilization is the fusion of two unicellular gametes
to produce one unicellular zygote.
Now, what is a gamete? Right, a gamete is the unisex term for a sex cell. Sperm, therefore, are gametes. Eggs are gametes. But they're gametes in different sexes, right? But in a sexual species, each of the two sexes produces its own gametes. Gametes is just a unisex term. Zygote, I've mentioned before, because I've said several times that you start your life out as a zygote, right? A zygote is a single cell that was created by fertilization when there was a fusion of your parents' gametes, a sperm from your father, an egg from your mother. Each individual cell is to start with, carrying their own chromosomes, fused together to produce one cell that's now carrying both sets of chromosomes from both parents. And that's why sex results in offspring that have traits of both parents, kind of a mixture of traits. Well, when this happens, when fertilization happens, that means the zygote has twice as much DNA as each gamete individually does, right? Because the zygote combines the DNA from both gametes. Therefore, based on hopefully your improving knowledge of what I just said ploidy is, based on a difference in ploidy between a gamete and a zygote, what would you say is true of the zygote? Well, in more generally, it is true, but more generally, you can say that fertilization results in a doubling of the ploidy, right? Because you're fusing two cells into one. One cell is now carrying both of those sets of DNA. Therefore, the ploidy has doubled in fertilization to create that zygote. Now, if that's the only thing that happened as far as the amount of chromosomes is concerned in each generation, that would mean that each generation would double the ploidy. Two diploid individuals would produce a tetraploid offspring, having four of each chromosome. And then two tetraploid individuals would get together to produce the following generation, which would be octoploid, having eight of every chromosome, right? Because it would double every time if all you had happening is fertilization. Well, hopefully it is clear to you that that would be impossible. It would get out of hand quickly. Because it's amazing enough how tightly packed the DNA is into not only an invisibly small cell, but an even smaller nucleus within that cell. We talked about how the chromatin is arranged with DNA around histones to make it as compact as it is. Well, if you double it every generation, it's only going to take a couple generations before it becomes impossible to fit all of that DNA. So, you can't have only fertilization in a sexual species. It would go extinct quickly because you can't keep doubling the number of DNA, or doubling the number of chromosomes. Therefore, in order for this to work, and you want this fertilization to work, because that's what gives you genetically different offspring that therefore can give you the advantage of having some of them maybe be better off in the new surroundings than you were. But the only way it can work is if you have a second mechanism that undoes the doubling of the ploidy. Fertilization has to double the ploidy for it to work. But in order for it not to become impossible, you have to have another mechanism that cuts the ploidy in half each generation to undo the doubling. And that's exactly what meiosis is. That's why it exists. Now you can see from the word that meiosis is very similar to the spelling of mitosis. And they have a lot of similarities, but they have really important differences as well. But meiosis is also a nuclear division. Remember that mitosis was defined as division of the nucleus in eukaryotic cells? Well, meiosis also is a type of division of the nucleus. But the reason it happens is not to produce two identical cells in a splitting event. The reason it happens, well, I mean, that does occur. I shouldn't really say it that way. But the reason it exists, meiosis, is to cut the ploidy in half in order to make gametes that have just half of the ploidy compared to those parents. And then when two parents get their gametes together in fertilization to produce offspring, the ploidy will not be double the parents, it will be back to what the parents are. All right, so meiosis is specifically division of the nucleus in eukaryotic cells that results in haploid cells being produced. Notice that this teal part of the cycle has in the key haploid as its name. It's N, it's the haploid number. So meiosis produces haploid cells from diploid cells. The whatever color this is, purplish brown color on the other half of the cycle, is the diploid part of the cycle. Well, that begins at fertilization. When two haploid gametes get together in fertilization to produce one zygote, that zygote is now diploid, right? A haploid sperm and a haploid egg add up to a diploid zygote. And then that diploid zygote doesn't remain in humans a single cell very long because it will then undergo mitosis. Mitosis does not change the ploidy. Meiosis does. It cuts it in half. Mitosis produces two cells of the same ploidy as the original. So that's how we become multicellular diploid humans. We live our life as multicellular diploid animals. But then at sexual maturity, each of us is able to produce by meiosis haploid gametes that can be used for the next generation. And this way it just goes back and forth between diploid, haploid, and it doesn't double. I mean, it doubles, then halves, then doubles, then halves, so it doesn't accumulate in successive generations. That's why you can't have fertilization without meiosis also. And that's why every species that is sexual, not just humans shown here, have this generation-to-generation alternation between fertilization and meiosis. All right, well, slide 5 gives you 3 more sexual life cycles that look very similar. And the left one is animals, as you see. We have most plants in the middle and most fungi on the right. But this animals one is just like the one we just looked at. Not surprising, because humans are animals, right? So all animals, not just humans, have a life cycle that looks like this. First of all, notice that all of them, according to what I just said, feature meiosis and fertilization. You'll have both of those somewhere in the life cycle. But what's different about these three is how much of the cycle is spent in the diploid versus the haploid phase. For animals, the haploid phase is the minority of the time. And the entire haploid phase, which is just the teal part, in animals, is unicellular. There aren't multicellular haploid humans. But every sperm is a unicellular haploid human. And every egg is a unicellular haploid human. Only if those two get together in fertilization, though, is a diploid cell created. And that diploid cell, by mitosis, becomes multicellular. So in animals, only the diploid phase features multicellularity. And we tend to think of only the multicellular organisms as being organisms, but that's not true. A sperm is a unicellular human that is haploid. Doesn't last very long, though, because one of two things is going to happen. Either a sperm is going to deliver its DNA to an egg in fertilization, in which case that's going to be a diploid individual at that point, or the sperm is just going to die. But, you know, they don't become multicellular in haploid, in animals in general. Okay, let's look at the other extreme first before going to the middle. This is most fungi. A mushroom, for instance. They're a little bit the reverse of us. Of course, they still have the same parts of the cell cycle. They still have fertilization and meiosis. They still have a diploid stage and a haploid stage. But what's reverse from our point of view is that most fungi spend their lives as multicellular haploid individuals. And the diploid part of the cell cycle is only unicellular. So when you see a fungus, that's a multicellular individual, right? Which is why you're able to see it. All of its cells are haploid cells. So they live their life in the haploid stage. When it comes time for them to produce gametes, either egg or sperm, they do not use meiosis to do that. It wouldn't make sense for a haploid cell to undergo meiosis, because haploid cells only have one of each chromosome, and meiosis reduces the ploidy. You can't reduce it below one. So since they're already haploid individuals, they produce their gametes by mitosis. Oh, sorry, right here. All right? Because mitosis creates the same kind of cells as what you started with. If they're already haploid, mitosis will produce more haploid cells. Those gametes then from two individuals can get together in fertilization to create a new generation. That's a zygote, just like it is in us. And it's diploid. But unlike us, that zygote is not going to become multicellular. Instead, that zygote immediately undergoes meiosis to cut the ploidy in half, and each of those haploid cells that is created will then undergo mitosis to create a multicellular body of the next fungal generation. You see the difference there? Compared to how we do things, we animals? Or is it unclear? Yeah, so when you see a fungus, its body is made up of haploid cells. It's a haploid individual. Whereas our body is made out of diploid cells. We animals are diploid individuals. Since a fungus is already haploid, and gametes have to be haploid, then it doesn't produce gametes by meiosis. It produces gametes by mitosis, just making more haploid cells from its already haploid cells. All right? When the haploid gametes of two different fungi, two parents, get together for fertilization, that produces a diploid zygote just like it does in us, except that zygote does not then undergo mitosis to become a multicellular embryo and grow up into a diploid adult like we do. Instead, that unicellular zygote in a fungus immediately undergoes meiosis, which cuts the ploidy from diploid to haploid as a single cell, and then those individual single cells undergo mitosis to become multicellular bodies of haploid fungi. Did that clear it up at all? Okay, well, now we can talk about the middle one, which is most plants. Plants exhibit what is called an alternation of generations. And I've already used that word alternation, so I don't want you to confuse that. All sexual species have an alternation from generation to generation between fertilization and meiosis. Okay? That's not what I'm talking about when I say alternation of generations. Plants have an alternation of generations, which refers to the fact that in plant species, both the diploid stage of the life cycle and the haploid stage of the life cycle are multicellular. I just went through how that was not true for animals. It's not true for fungi either, right? One of the two phases is unicellular only, and then back to the next phase. But in plants, there are two versions of the same species. A haploid multicellular plant, that's this one, called the gametophyte. Phyte means plant, by the way. So gametophyte means gamete-producing plant. And the same species, but a different version of the species, a diploid version that's also multicellular. Now, in the vastly most successful group of plants, which are the angiosperms, and just about any plant that you come into contact with nowadays is an angiosperm. They're so successful. You don't really see both versions of the plant, because one lives inside the other for half of that cycle. But in more primitive plants that existed before there were angiosperms, there are actually two free-living versions that look different, but they're the same species. And one of them is a multicellular body made out of haploid cells, and the other is a multicellular body made out of diploid cells. So the parents, the offspring of the parents are different in ploidy, but they're both multicellular. That's what's different compared to these other extremes. And that's why it's called an alternation of generations. Any questions on any of this so far? All right. Then let's go to six and focus on the particulars of meiosis. Remember, keep in mind the intent, in a sense, of meiosis, the reason that it has to exist. The reason that meiosis has to exist is to cut the ploidy in half so that when the ploidy doubles again in fertilization, you just get back to where you started from rather than only keeping doubling it. All right, that's the whole purpose of it. This is the simplest possible figure, but it's actually too simple and makes it a little bit confusing, I think. But whatever species this is supposed to represent, this top cell, first of all, look at just the top cell. What is the N for that cell? Yes. N equals 1 for this. This is why it's the simplest possible example. But it actually makes it a little bit more difficult to understand than if they had used N of 2. But anyway, does everyone see why N equals 1 here? What does the phrase N equals 1 mean? It means that there's only one type of chromosome. Because N in general, whatever the number is, always means the number of different types of chromosomes the cell has, or the species has. There's only one kind of chromosome here. This size, basically. Now there's two chromosomes here, right? And therefore, what word would you use to describe the cell? It's a diploid cell with an N of 1. The diploid number is always 2N. So that's why there are two chromosomes here. There's two of each type. There's only one type, but there's two of them. It's a diploid cell. And the red and blue just indicate which parent those chromosomes came from. Yeah.
So 2N is just like adding all the numbers up?
Yes. 2N is the diploid number simply because N is the haploid number. And diploid means having two of each of those types. Therefore, however many types there are, which is N, a diploid cell is going to have 2N total chromosomes. Okay, good. Another problem with this slide, other than using even too simple an example, is that this top cell, is this picture is a lie. Why is it a lie?
It's not a homologous pair.
It is a homologous pair. These are the same type of chromosome, and that's what homologous means. There's only one type of chromosome here. That's what N equals 1 means, right? So they're both the same type. Same size, carrying the same number and types of genes. One from each of the two parents, though. So that's not the lie. Why wouldn't you see this, a cell that this cartoon represents, in reality? Well, what kind of chromosomes are we looking at here on just the top picture? Not replicated. These are unreplicated chromosomes. And so why does that mean it's a lie? When does replication occur?
No.
When in the cell cycle does replication occur?
Metaphase.
That's part of mitosis.
Interphase.
The S phase. The S phase of interphase, exactly. S is for synthesis of DNA. Yeah. And when does chromatin condense?
In the mitosis?
Yes. Which is after the S phase, right? So by the time you see a chromosome, and use the word chromosome, it's already replicated. You wouldn't see this. It would just be, instead, diffuse chromatin. You wouldn't see any individual pieces. But it's hard to look at there. That's why they didn't draw it that way. So we're pretending that it's condensed, even though it wouldn't be before replication. Does everyone understand what I'm talking about here? So this just shows you, even though it's not really chromosomes that you see, this shows you how much DNA is there and the fact that it hasn't yet been replicated. Now, this cell goes through the S phase. Therefore, when that chromatin finally does condense into individual chromosomes that we see, each of those visible chromosomes is already replicated. So this one's correct. All right? But now we can see that each chromosome is a replicated chromosome consisting of two identical sister chromatids. And the red homologue is also a replicated chromosome consisting of two identical sister chromatids. But a blue chromatid and a red chromatid are not sister chromatids. They're not identical to each other because they came from different parents. And those parents were not genetically identical. Okay? Now all of this is before we get to meiosis. Meiosis, when it happens, is a division, just like mitosis is. But this brings up one of the important differences between meiosis and mitosis. Mitosis involves one division event. Meiosis, on the other hand, involves two separate division events, one before the other. And therefore, overall meiosis, the whole process, consists of two subphases called meiosis I and meiosis II, Roman numerals. You can see the result of meiosis I right here, using this cell that's entering meiosis. Is it clear that this is a diploid cell that's entering meiosis? Why is it diploid? Because it has not two kinds. No, two kinds would mean N equals two. There's two of each kind, and there's only one kind. And this is why I wish that they had used two chromosomes. Okay, if you had a cell with these chromosomes, how many kinds are there? Two. And therefore, N equals what? Two. Is it haploid or diploid? It's diploid because there are two of each of those two kinds. Here, there's only one kind, but there are two of each of that one kind. That's why it's diploid. And I said that people get hung up on this at first all the time. But is it getting clearer in your head? You know, if we added one, now what is N? What is it? No, N is not 2. N is 3. N is always how many types of chromosomes there are. There are 3 types, 3 sizes. What's the ploidy now?
Diploid.
It's still diploid, because it's still true that there are 2 of each type. It's just that there's 1 more type. There's still 2 of each type, though. That's the ploidy. Ploidy is always how many of each type, not how many there are, or how many types there are. How many types there are is N. How many of each type is ploidy. And meiosis does not affect N at all. Meiosis affects ploidy. Mitosis doesn't affect N or ploidy. Whatever the N and the ploidy is for a cell that enters mitosis, mitosis will spit out 2 cells with the same N and the same ploidy as the original cell. Mitosis just makes genetically identical copies of cells. Whatever the ploidy in, same ploidy out. Meiosis takes a cell with whatever N, and that is diploid, and produces cells that are the same N, but now haploid. So meiosis does not affect N, it affects ploidy. And that's the whole reason it has to exist, remember. You have to reduce the ploidy in half to make up for the fact that fertilization doubles it. You undo fertilization's doubling by cutting it in half, the ploidy. What were you going to ask?
Oh, so would you say the ploidy is opposite?
This one is also diploid because ploidy always refers to how many of each type. There's 3 types, that's what N equals 3 means. But there's 2 large, 2 medium, 2 small. So there's 2 of each type. And that's what diploid means.
So what is it called when you're how many types?
If I count the entire number of chromosomes, that would be 2N, the diploid number. And since N equals 3 here, the total number of chromosomes is 2N equals 6. What's 2N for humans?
Did you say 23?
That's N.
Oh.
46. The vast majority, almost all, of your cells in your body have 46 chromosomes. Now, your red blood cells aren't included because they don't have nuclei. But they started out with nuclei, they just lose them. Anyway, you're made up of, we are animals, so we live our multicellular part of our life cycle as diploids. Right? And so you're made out, what you call yourself is made out of a mass of diploid cells, each of which has 46 chromosomes, because it has 2 number 1s, 2 number 2s, all the way through 23 types. Well, in this simple example, there's only 1 type, N equals 1. So, but this is still a diploid cell because there are 2 of that type. They're the same type, though, because they govern the same set of characteristics. The genes are the same, even though they might not be the same versions of genes. Everyone good to go on to what's happening at the split here? Okay, in meiosis 1, very importantly, that is where the reduction in ploidy happens. I already told you before that meiosis reduces the ploidy. It cuts it in half. That cutting in half of the ploidy occurs in meiosis 1, not in meiosis 2. So this cell right before meiosis 1 happens in the picture is a cell that has two replicated chromosomes of the same type, right? One homologous pair. And this is another reason why it's kind of confusing to use an N of one, but they are lined up here at metaphase. Meiosis has the same subphase names as mitosis does. So prophase, metaphase, and so on, those occur in meiosis as well. They occur in each of the two subphases of meiosis. So there's a prophase of meiosis 1, and then later there's a prophase of meiosis 2, and similarly for the other subphases. But here's something that is really key to understand, to making sense of meiosis, which is confusing at first, I admit. You have to compare what you already know about mitosis to meiosis. So this is meiosis. Kind of ignore it for a second while I just talk about mitosis. Think about mitosis, which you already hopefully know. In metaphase of mitosis, things line up, right? That's what defines metaphase. What is it in metaphase that line up?
Is it the chromatid?
No, not chromatids individually. Chromatids are just part of replicated chromosomes, right? While they're still connected, a chromatid is not a chromosome in its own right yet. Two sister chromatids held together at the centromere make up one replicated chromosome. Right? And so those don't line up. They're still connected to each other in replicated chromosomes. What lines up during metaphase of mitosis are individual replicated chromosomes. Let me see whether I can draw that with an N of 2 more simply. So this is for mitosis. For an N of 2, you have two different sizes, right? But a diploid cell is going to have two of each of those sizes. You see how this is an N of 2 for this cell? Large and small are the two types. And it's diploid because there are two large and there are two small. Well, if this is mitosis, which is what I drew, then in metaphase, what line up are individual replicated chromosomes. I define today the term homologous. This big one is homologous to the other big one, right? But in mitosis, they don't care. The cell doesn't care. We don't use the word homologous in mitosis because the two number ones don't care where each other are. You know, the other one could be down here. It doesn't have to be next to it. And the two number twos don't care where each other are. All four individual replicated chromosomes line up individually. In meiosis, on the other hand, what lines up during metaphase of meiosis one is not individual replicated chromosomes, but homologous pairs of replicated chromosomes. Like that. Okay? This is the metaphase plate, just like it was right here. But it's not individual replicated chromosomes lining up. Homologous pairs are lining up. In meiosis, the two number ones do care where each other are. They find each other and come together. And the two number twos find each other and come together. Do you see this fundamental difference? This is really key to understanding it all. And that's why it's confusing here, because it is happening, but since there's only one type, you can't really see that these are lined up as a pair. For humans, you would have 23 different pairs lining up in meiosis. But in humans, mitosis, you would have 46 things lining up. Okay? That's a crucial difference between mitosis and meiosis. What lines up in metaphase of mitosis compared to what lines up in metaphase of meiosis 1? Since there is a difference in terms of what lines up, there's also a difference when it comes to anaphase. What is the hallmark of anaphase? What's the big event? Splitting, exactly. So also key to understanding the difference between mitosis and meiosis is understanding what splits during anaphase of each of these. So think about mitosis first, which you've already learned. What is it that split apart in anaphase of mitosis? Not centrioles. Centrioles are the T-shaped licorice things in the centrosomes. Sister chromatids separate during anaphase of mitosis, and that's when they're no longer called chromatids anymore, right? They turn into daughter chromosomes. They just get renamed that. They don't really change. But that's what splits. So this sister chromatid splits from this sister chromatid, and so on for all these others. Okay? Well, that's not what splits in anaphase of meiosis. In meiosis, or meiosis 1 I'm talking about, since what lined up at metaphase of meiosis 1 are pairs of replicated chromosomes, homologous pairs, then what splits are not chromatids, but homologs making up each pair. So this red homolog is going to go one way, the black homolog is going to go the other way, but each homolog is still replicated. All right? Now, when that happens, the two cells that are produced are already haploid. Do you see that? Because each of these two cells, unlike the original one, has only one of each type of chromosome. The N is the same. The N is still 2 here. But now these two cells each have just one of each type. So they are both haploid cells. It's the splitting of homologs from each other that actually reduces the ploidy in meiosis. And so that's the most important event. That's the whole reason the entire process exists. So look at this picture where N equals 1. It's harder to understand here, but now that you have seen this, hopefully you'll see that what has split here in meiosis 1 are not sister chromatids, but homologs of a homologous pair. This cell gets one of the homologs, this cell gets the other homolog, and that's what makes them already haploid. Well, the goal of meiosis, in a sense, is to cut the ploidy in half. So why aren't we done? We've already done that. We're not done because even though the ploidy is correct now, it's haploid in each of these cells, each cell still has a replicated chromosome, not an unreplicated chromosome. So you have to have another round that's very similar to mitosis to split the two sister chromatids apart. That happens for each of these two interim cells. And so the final product of meiosis, since there are two rounds of splitting, are four cells, not two like in mitosis. Four cells consisting of that are all haploid. And we no longer use the word homologous because the homologs are in totally different cells at this point. All right? Not only are they haploid, though, which they were even after meiosis I, they are haploid and unreplicated. The chromosomes are unreplicated. That's when you're done. And I have to be done as well. So we'll continue next time.